Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. We're going to get started. There's friends. My name is Cameron Murphy, and I'm a representative of Fertile Ground Environmental Institute. Fertile Ground is a 5-year-old environmental education nonprofit. We promote oppositional cultures and communities of resistance as strategies to challenge the powers that be, from capitalism to colonialism to civilization itself. Yesterday was an amazing day. We had, we saw keynote speeches from Thomas Lindsay and Derek Jensen. We had a panel on climate change and ecological collapse, and another panel on communities of resistance and warriorhood. We had the poetry of Dominique Christina, and we had a panel on colonization, land theft, and indigenous life. So please join me again in thanking all of yesterday's speakers. We're here now on stolen land. This is a lonely land. This is not American land. And we're here to prepare ourselves for the hard work that lies ahead. I hope that you're all able to leave here today feeling inspired and stimulated, excited, and maybe even challenged about your role in this movement. We have 3 panels today, as well as 3 incredible keynote speakers. The panels are divided roughly in half, the first half being speeches, the second half being Q&A discussion. We ask that you fill out any note cards that you have. If you need note cards, they're on the side here at the entrance. Fill out any questions, and we're going to pass them to the left, and someone will collect them, and they'll run them up to the moderator before the discussion.
You said
your left? Yes, this side here. Okay. We're going to have a 10-minute break at 10:50 this morning. Bathrooms and water in the lobby. We're going to have lunch at noon. There are restaurants nearby, and if you ordered a catered lunch, you can pick it up in the lobby then. We'll have another break at 2:30, and then the event is going to end tonight at 6 o'clock. If you have a medical emergency, please alert an organizer or a security person. If there's a larger emergency, there are exits in the rear and on the sides of the theater. If that happens, an organizer will come to the stage and make an announcement so we can have an orderly exit. Lastly, I just want to extend thanks to all of the speakers for traveling here today. I want to thank all the other organizers and supporters for helping make this event happen. And I want to thank our donors for making this whole event possible. And, yeah, thank you. Before we start with the panels, I would like to introduce a writer and a speaker who has deeply influenced my own thinking and my life. I can think of no better way to start a conference like this than with his words. So please help me welcome Derek Jensen.
So I'd like to thank you for coming at this god-awful time of the morning. Also like to thank the Wallace Action Fund. And that wouldn't have happened without them, so we should. Also all the organizers who did a fabulous job. And also people who don't get acknowledged often enough are the sound and video people, and they're doing a great job. Okay, so since a lot of today is about confronting misogyny, I thought I'd read a piece called The Man Box. The man box is full of proof, except that there is no man box. The man box can never be filled, and real men don't need proof. Let's start with Abraham and Isaac. You know the story. God tells Abraham to slit his child's throat. Abraham ties up his son, raises the knife, and at the last moment, God says it was a test. End of story. Lesson? Abraham shows, by his willingness to violate his child, the proof of his worth. And Isaac learns that his father was willing to kill him rather than act against the cult of masculinity, against the rules of the man box. There are many rules of the man box, even though there is no man box and there are no rules. Why call it a box when it's the way things are? And why call it a rule when it's who you are? Rule one, there is no man box. Rule two, there is no box but the man box, and thou shalt have no other boxes before it. Rule three, that's the way things are. Rule four, that's who you are. So I'm in a restaurant, and I overhear one guy say to another that he's in pain. The other responds, suck it up. When are you going to quit being such a woman? So yes, I understand that men are taught to not feel. Yes, I understand that the cult of masculinity is all about not feeling. I understand that must be hard. But honestly, I don't give a shit about understanding the emotional state of members of the cult of masculinity, except insofar as that understanding might help stop them. It's a bit late in the game to be worried about the feelings of perpetrators. The ones I care about are their victims, because the man box isn't about putting men in a box. It's about putting everybody else in a box. The box of other, the box of less than, of trophies, the box of the violable, the box of the targets, the box of victims, the box of the violated, the box of proof of the man's own manhood. Have you ever done the math on how many women who are alive right now have been raped? There's almost 7 billion people on the planet, so there's about 3.5 billion women. About 1 in 4 women is raped in her lifetime, another 1 in 5 fend off rape attempts. And all the women I know say those figures are actually much higher. So more than 800 million women living today will be raped in their lifetimes. Let's say half of those have not yet been raped. So 400 million women living right now have been raped. And another now, and another right now. This also means, among many other things, unless a few men are excruciatingly busy, there are a lot of rapists out there. A lot of members of the cult of masculinity. A lot of men who adhere to the rules of the man box. But you knew that. But of course there is no man box, and there can be no man box, because if there were a man box, that would mean there's something outside the man box. And there's nothing outside the man box, because there can be nothing outside the man box, and there can be nothing outside the man box, because there must be nothing outside the man box. Because if there were, well, there isn't. Can't be, mustn't be. Because if there were, that would mean that members of the cult of masculinity aren't as completely potent as they must be. And also because if there were, why would any victims put up with this shit? So there must not be a man box, because everything's part of the man box. That is, everything is violable, and everything must be violated. Rule five, which is actually rule one, which is actually the only rule there is, I exist only insofar as I violate you. But of course, rule five does not exist, nor does rule one. The other day I saw an astronomer saying why he thought it was important to explore Mars and other planets. It will, he said, answer that most important question of all. Are we all alone? I have an even more important question. Is he fucking crazy? No, he's just a member of the cult of masculinity. Did you know that 200 years ago there were flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darkened the sky for days at a time? And flocks of Eskimo curlews so thick that 10, 15, 20 birds would fall to a single shot. There are so many whales in the North Atlantic they were a hazard to shipping. And there are runs of salmon so thick they would keep you awake all night with the slapping of their tails against the water. And he asks if we're all alone. Of course you're alone if you're a member of the cult of masculinity. Then you're alone with other members of your cult because you've declared yourself to be the only one who matters, the one who does too, as opposed to everyone else to whom it is done. Did you know that this culture is driving 200 species extinct each and every day, and that stolid scientists are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish in 50 years? And do you know why? Do you know the world used to be filled with thousands of vibrant human cultures, and that human cultures are being driven extinct at an even faster relative rate than non-human species? And do you know why? The man box is full of women. It's full of passenger pigeons. It's full of whales. It's full of indigenous humans. The man box is full of the entire world. But the man box isn't full because the man box, which does not exist, can never be full. The psychiatrist R.D. Lang famously asked, how do you plug a void plugging a void? And that's the question, isn't it? But of course it isn't the question because men don't have a void, and even if they did have a void, they certainly wouldn't plug it with a void. I said yesterday that any hatred, or maybe any void, felt long enough no longer feels like hatred, but rather like religion or economics or science or tradition or just the way things are. So with all the world at stake, I need to speak plainly. The problem is that within this patriarchy, identity itself is based on violation. Violation becomes not merely an action, but an identity. Who you are and how you and society define who you are. Within this patriarchy, men's masculinity defines itself by identifying others, any and all others, as inferior, which is why those stupid fucking scientists can ask, are we all alone, if they destroy the life on this planet? And as being therefore violable, and then violating them. For men under this patriarchy, these acts of violating others are how we become who we are. They validate who we are. They then reaffirm who we are, as through these repeated acts of violation, we come to perceive each new violation as reinforcement not only of our superiority over this other we violated, but as simply the way things are. So without this identification of others as inferior, without this violation, we are not. And so we're a void. And so we fill this void, fill it with validations of our superiority, fill it with violations, thus the rapes, thus the violation of every boundary set up by every indigenous culture, thus the extinctions, thus the insane belief in an economic system based on infinite growth despite the fact that we live on a finite planet. Thus the refusal to accept any limits on technological progress, which is more properly termed technological escalation, as it really involves an escalation of the wielder's ability to control and violate at a distance, or any limits on scientific, quote, knowledge. Thus the sending of probes to penetrate the deepest folds of the ocean, thus the bombing of the moon. What makes this problem even worse is that because there are always those who have yet to be violated, and because this violation isn't really solving the needs it purports to meet, it's a void plugging a void, the drive to violate is insatiable. This culture will continue to violate until there is nothing left to violate, nothing left. So what's at stake in the whole discussion today is life on the planet. This cult of masculinity must not merely be left and must not merely be exposed, it must be destroyed, or it will continue to violate its way to the end of all that's alive. But before we can leave this cult of masculinity, we must understand that it is not all that is, that there is a cult of masculinity and there is a man box, and you can leave them both. So burn this into your heart. This imperative to violate is not natural. It's cultural. We must resist every effort by the abusers, by the violators, to naturalize this drive to violate. For that's what abusers and violators must do. They must attempt to convince themselves and everybody else that their way is the only way, that there is no other way. They must convince themselves and everyone else that not only is there nowhere outside the cult of masculinity, nowhere outside the man box, but indeed that there exists neither a cult of masculinity nor a man box. There's only this way of life, which is not just a way of life, because it encompasses all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. It is everything, they say. But they are lying to themselves and to you. Even if they have an entire culture to back them up, they're still lying. We must never forget that. There is a cult of masculinity, and there is a man box, and we can leave them. We can not only leave them, we can destroy them. We must. With all the world at stake, we must. So thank you.
So our first panel this morning is on capitalism and sociopathology. And this will consist of Charles Derber, Derek Jensen, and Stephanie McMillan. And the moderator is Stan Goff.
Good morning. Before I bring the panelists down, before I announce who the panelists, go ahead. Go. I've been asked to just let you all know, I guess I don't keep up with football much, but I guess there's a football game today here in San Francisco, and one of the teams is called the Washington Redskins. Some folks that are going out there and, I guess, doing a pretty substantial protest today. Just wanted to let you all know, that that's going on. And I guess just letting people know that name is not okay. So, yeah, thank you. And I just want to take a minute to say thank you to the organizers of this event. They've been working their tails off for a few days, and it's really nice to see that they could put this many butts in the seats out here today. We've got three people on the panel. They're going to talk about capitalism as sociopathology. One of them probably doesn't need much of an introduction because he's been out here a couple times. That's that guy sitting in the middle right there, Derek. On his left right there is Stephanie McMillan. Stephanie has been a political cartoonist. Okay, you got Pam. There we go. She's been a political cartoonist since 1992. She's the creator of the editorial cartoon Code Green and a comic strip, Minimum Security. She's written seven books, including Capitalism Must Die, A Brief Introduction to Capitalism, What It Is, Why It Sucks, and How to Crush It. Subtle. She's been an organizer all her life, and Stephanie is a founding member of the anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist group, One Struggle. And she also contributes political theory to a publishing project called Idées Nouvelles and Idées Prolétariennes. I don't speak French very well, so... And the other panelist to the right, there is my right, your left, is Charles Derber. He's a writer who studies big picture of American culture and global capitalism. His recent books focus on climate change, capitalism, globalization, terrorism, and the culture of hegemony, the power of multinational corporation. He's also written extensively on the American dream and the crisis of individualism that defines American life, showing how our problems of community are organically tied to economic and political forces. And with that, I guess I'll bring them up from my right, your left, your right, my left. I'll start with Charles. And I need to let people have to say Charles because they have to turn on his PowerPoint in the back here. So Charles is coming up. Turn on his PowerPoint, and then we'll work our way across through Derek and Stephanie. Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. How are you? Getting up at 9:45 in the morning is... Oh, you can't hear me. This is on. Can you hear me now? Thank you. Yeah. Well, wonderful to see everybody up this early. I want to start by thanking this wonderful group of organizers and thinkers who put this thing together. My God, what a creative, inspired, passionate group of people. This is a panel about sociopathology. What's the opposite of sociopathology? I've been bathed in the opposite of sociopathology ever since I got here. So do you have a word for me as to what is the opposite of sociopathology? Freedom, love, sociophilia. I don't know, but it feels like I've been loved out here by people like Max and Seva and Courtney and so forth. It's been Cameron's... Oh, yeah, I got to keep this thing up. Sorry. Okay, just keep telling me. Can you hear me back there? Yeah. So anyway, don't forget, this is a wonderful, inspired, passionate group of people who have put this together, and it's wonderful to see you out here. I also want to thank one of my co-panelists, Derek, because I think he's partly responsible for my being here. He invited me on his show, which started a conversation which I think will probably continue for a while. So thank you, Derek, for your help in getting me out here. So I'm going to start with a couple of questions. And you just tell me, raise your hand to the following questions. First of all, I think Derek asked this yesterday. How many of you think that capitalism is a sociopathic system? Okay. Friendly group, as you noticed. How many of you, this is a little more complex question, how many of you think that capitalism can be reformed so that it is not sociopathic? Okay, still a friendly audience. Third question, how many of you think it's possible to construct in your lifetime an economic system which is not sociopathic? Wow. So we have some optimists in the crowd. I'm glad to see that, because some of the talk got pretty dark yesterday. Maybe Sunday things brighten up a little bit. It was sunny out there. Okay. And I'm going to ask you one other question which gets to the issue about what we're talking about when we're talking about a sociopathic system. And this is a very personal question, so try to be honest. How many of you think of yourselves, are you a sociopath? Okay, so as I'm looking there, about a third of the people in the audience acknowledge to being a sociopath. Now, that's... I'm not trying to embarrass anybody. What I'm trying to do is try to just clarify the idea. Let me turn this clicker on and see if I can get it moving. I rarely use PowerPoints. You know, sociopathy is usually described as a personality characteristic. And increasingly, in fact, people are talking about it as a neurological pattern. And they're finding limbic neurological forces that lead to sociopathy. I'm trying to argue, one of my more recent books is called Sociopathic Society, that the idea of sociopathy should be applied not only to individuals but to systems, to economic and political systems. And what I mean by that is a system, as I put there, which is based on antisocial social norms and which essentially prescribes and rewards sociopathic behavior. And if you ask the question, you all thought that capitalism was sociopathic, but a lot of you didn't think of yourselves as sociopathic. And then that raises the question, is that a contradiction? How can you be living in a sociopathic society if you're not a sociopath? And this is important in trying to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about sociopathic systems. It's a question like, how can a social value be antisocial? There's kind of a conceptual riddle there. And there's a couple of things I want to say is, first of all, social norms are created by ruling elites in most societies, and certainly in capitalist society. And so social norms can be antisocial in the sense that social norms are constructed by elites. And therefore, there's sort of rules and values which are then reinforced in the larger society. But the nature of a sociopathic system is that whether you're personally a sociopath or not, if you're living in this system will essentially require or strongly incentivize you to act in a sociopathic way. So when I talk about this, Derek, in his discussion, may give a slightly different focus to this. But what I'm talking about are forms of behavior dictated by the society that will be carried out by you whether or not you're a sociopath, right? It's in the nature of the system to require behavior that may or may not be something that you would choose to do purely from your own psychological disposition. And this is a very unorthodox concept. There is not in social science or social theory generally a broad definition of systems as sociopathic. The cutting-edge research on sociopathy and psychopathology is always more biological and always more, you know, it's like a brain disorder. And I'm not saying that that stuff is not involved, but what I'm interested in talking about here is the systemic, social, political characteristics of a sociopathic system. Okay? So, since you guys already think of it as such, you know, one thing that happens to many of us on the left, we get visceral instincts. Yeah, capitalism is sociopathic. How? Okay, I want to quickly go through how I think sociopathy operates. So let me just go to the next slide. So the first idea in capitalism is that in capitalism, only individuals exist. That is the fundamental epistemological reality. Only individuals and aggregates of individuals exist. There is no community. And the purpose of the individual is to pursue self-interest on the market. That is the mission, the moral mission of the individual. And the idea is that this pursuit of self-interest is the only good. In fact, if you look at the quote from Ayn Rand, one of the great popular philosophers of modern conservatism, you can read it there. If any civilization is to survive, it is the morality of altruism that men have to reject. Okay? That is a core RAND position. Think about that. If you act unselfishly, you are acting immorally. The only moral behavior is to act. And Adam Smith, who was the founder of capitalist theology, basically, embraced that idea that society, if there is a society, the well-being of people will occur only if people act out of self-interest. To be altruistic is to be immoral. Think about that. That's the society that we're living in. Okay, I'm going to move quickly just because of the time thing. So capitalism operates under the principle of competition. It's a very flawed and managed and controlled system. Social Darwinism, which is a deeply distorted view of Darwin's idea of how nature works, is the sort of basic ideology that governs that competition. But the core I want to point out is that the way that capitalist competition operates is if you don't act sociopathically toward your workers, toward consumers, toward your competitive rivals in the market, you will go under. See, it doesn't matter whether you're a nice person, not a nice person, somewhere in between. The competitive structure of capitalism requires that you act in a way that is going to be brutal and bullying and violent toward your workers and your consumers and so forth. Marx said it. He said, the worker bows to the command, direction, and the supervision of the capitalist. The social Darwinist, part by John D. Rockefeller in 1890, who was the country's first billionaire in 1890 when 90% of the population was poor, said, God gave me my money. Okay. Sociopathy number three. These are seven pillars of sociopathy. The violence toward nature, which much of this conference has been discussing. My premise is that capitalism is inherently violent, moves toward ecocide, is going to destroy the environment. Why is that the case? First of all, because there is only the concept of the individual, there is no concept of the commons. The commons does not exist in capitalism. Air, water, I've heard the head of the Chamber of Commerce say, every bit of water, air, natural resource should be privately owned, because that is the only concept that works within a capitalist model. So we start with the fact that there is no commons. There is no environment that has public meaning. Capitalism derives climate change for at least four reasons. One, it has no values other than profit. So it will treat the earth as a commodity to be exploited for profit. It externalizes environmental costs, meaning that those costs are not registering on the market. The market is blind to environmental costs. It requires unfettered growth, and it requires fetishized consumption. Consumption is the source of happiness and is kind of turns into an object of religion. Fourth point, militarism. We ought to have peace people here from all over San Francisco and the West, because capitalism and ecocide and militarism are also connected. Why does capitalism drive sociopathic warfare? It's part of the competitive process. Capitalism is an expansive system. If you're going to win the competition, you have to expand. Very often you do that through trade, but very often you have to do that through militarism. And so every leading capitalist order, not every capitalist country, because capitalism produces hegemons, dominant capitalist countries that manage the global capitalist order. In that case, which country is that in the world today? It's the United States, right? We have far, far more military power because we are playing that role of hegemonic military force for the global capitalist system. And Noam Chomsky, a friend of mine, good friend of mine, says, capitalists fight for the fifth freedom, which is greed. Franklin Roosevelt identified four freedoms. And Tom Friedman, not one of my favorite writers, said McDonald's cannot exist without McDonnell Douglas, which is, of course, a military company. That's a famous phrase. Fifth, capitalism is by its nature profoundly hierarchical and divided between people who own wealth and property and people who don't. That is the definition of capitalism. a division between two tiers of people. In that division, and this has been shown most recently by a very mainstream economist named Thomas Piketty, who wrote this book on capital in the 21st century, which shows that over 300 years in 25 countries, capitalism, with only one exception, which is a period of great warfare where a lot of wealth was destroyed, has led toward greater and greater polarization of wealth. And he's predicting that we're moving into a 21st century where almost certainly, not the 1%, but the 0.1 of the 1% will own and control 90% of the financial assets of the country. Right now, the 1% owns about 50% of the country. 50% of the country has no wealth at all. So we're in a kind of sociopathic division. Piketty, whose book is selling more than Thin Thighs in 30 days, it's a dense economic history of 800 pages of data on the distribution of capital and wealth. I've just written a popular commentary on this book. So if you don't want to read the 800 pages, but you want to get the sense of what this book is about, you might want to look at that. He writes, the more perfect the market in the economist's sense, the more likely inequality will get worse and worse. And he's predicting a kind of return to a pre-capitalist feudal era of nobility where their inherited wealth dominates the economy. Inherited wealth, caste. We're moving from a class system back to a caste system where people are locked into a permanent economic station and cannot move. And this leads to a hierarchy of essentially essence, where the essence of people will be defined not only by their gender and their race, but by the economic station God gave me my wealth that they are born into. Another really terrible thing about capitalism is because it produces things not on the basis of their value to people, but in terms of the profit that they can deliver, we are producing a glut of totally destructive products, right? America is just full of products we don't need and which are an assault on the planet. And I just mentioned junk food, tobacco, guns and weapons, toxic Wall Street instruments, oil. You could mention a lot more. So we're glutting the planet with products that are sociopathic. They are destroying the social order. They're destroying the natural order. At the same time, we have the word deficit is always thrown around. We have one real deficit that matters. It's not the deficit you read about in the paper. It's a deficit of what I call public goods. There's no concept of public goods in capitalism. Public goods are those created through the commons and through the state. But in capitalism, there is no value that can be created outside of private property. So the government and the community is perceived as incapable of constructing anything of value. So what are public goods? What are public goods? It's hard for you to think about it. Maintaining the commons. Education. What else? Healthcare. Conversation, community, love. These are public goods. These are the basis of a good society, public transportation. And so I just want you to understand there's plenty of room for production and growth in our society. We just have to eliminate this enormous growth of sociopathic products and move toward creating public goods, which actually are consistent with the sustainability of the planet and with the well-being and your happiness. We live in a society where we don't even talk about the deficit of public goods because there's no concept of public goods. And Galbraith noticed this when he said, we live in an atmosphere of private opulence and public squalor. Public squalor. And the private goods have full sway. That's the way capitalism works. That's the way capitalism inherently works. Finally, I'm going to wrap up here, politics, sociopathic politics. Democracy is fictive. It's a fiction. This idea goes back to Marx, that democracy, the government is created. It's simply, the managing committee of the capitalist class in Marxist terms. What it means is that the simplest way to think about this is because wealth is so concentrated in the United States, there is, and now when you think about things like Citizens United and McCutcheon and all of the tearing down of all of the regulations of the use of money in politics, the state is simply a fig leaf for the organization of Wall Street, for the mission of Wall Street and large corporations like Exxon and the coal companies and all of these sociopathic institutions which operate in the, you know, with the help and the subsidy of the state. We saw it during the bailout of the banks. So we have procedural democracy. We still vote. We have the procedures of voting. Capitalism is very, very clever about its way of maintaining, unlike many other dictatorships in the world, maintaining the cosmetics of a democratic order while following the essentially autocracy of a quite brutal sociopathic capitalist system. I call this corpocracy. The word corpocracy, it brings together corporations, democracy, because it acts in the language of democracy, but and the people vote. But whether you vote for Bush or Bush Light, you're going to be carrying out a corporate capitalist agenda, right? So you're left with a politics which is a sham, which is what accounts for the spectacle of politics and the withdrawal. You know, in the last election, the tsunami of the right, something like 20% of the population voted, of the electorate voted. People are just opting out because they have some sense of the fiction of democracy. And the state carries out, this is crucial, because the sociopathy of capitalism is carried out to a large degree by the state. And it does so in the name of the people. So the only way that we can change this system is by changing people's understanding of how politics in the capitalist system operates. Louis Brandeis, I used to teach at Brandeis, said, we can have democracy in this country or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. Thank you for your attention. I hope it was a bit.
Everybody. I want to thank the organizers for bringing me here. I'm really happy to participate in this conference and be here with all of you. Even more, I want to thank you all for getting up early on a Sunday morning, determined to investigate and understand the different aspects of this catastrophic situation that we're facing. We're all facing it together. I especially want to thank those of you here who are doing something about it or thinking about doing something about it. That's very important that we do. Charles did a very good job of describing a lot of the tendencies and characteristics of capitalism, and I'm going to get into some of the more structural aspects. So we all know that capitalism's killing the world. In order to stop it, we can't just keep resisting its effects. Capitalism doesn't care if we protest on street corners 1,000 times. That just proves how democratic they are. The solutions are not to be found within its framework, and they're even less to be found at the individual level. We don't actually have any power as consumers, as I'm sure most of you here already know. They would like us to think we do, but we can't buy or refrain from buying our way out of this. It's a social system, a class system, and it can only be addressed at the level of collective, organized class struggle. We need to understand capital, how it works, the mechanisms that keep it in place, and that are at the core of its functioning. Capitalism is a mode of production based on the exploitation of labor in the generation of surplus value. This means that workers are paid a certain amount of wages for a day's work, but what they produce is worth more than that. The extra value is called surplus value, and the capitalist just steals it. This is what all profit is based on. This is what private property is all about. It's considered normal for the social means of production, the factories, land, and everything that produces all the things that we all use, that these are privately owned, and for those owners to simply take whatever is produced in them or with them. Capitalism is not just an economic process, but it's the whole way that our society is arranged. It's an ensemble or matrix of social relations. And these comprise three main fields: the economic, political, and ideological. The economic field is determinant. Profit is the point, and everything else is set up to solidify the relations of production that keep it coming. Capitalist ideology, centered on competition and individualism, is designed to make the way we live seem normal and inevitable. It's forced on us by its institutions, school, the church, the nuclear family, media, and culture. Why would we need advertising, for example, if they didn't need to convince us to participate? Ideological domination is unrelenting conditioning and indoctrination to naturalize capitalism, to make us compliant, passive, greedy, and self-centered, to make us identify with it instead of understanding it as the enemy that it really is. Political domination, the job of the state, has two main aims. The first, performed by the government and its laws, is to regulate the relations within and between classes, to keep the flow of capital smooth and free of obstacles. The second is for when ideological domination fails, when we can no longer accept living this way, the state turns to coercion through terrorism. This function is performed by the state's armed forces, its military and police. If we don't comply, that's when the guns come out. We saw that with the Occupy movement. The entire purpose of this setup is economic. The accumulation of wealth for a small minority of people, those who own the means of production, namely the factories, tools, land. This ownership was not ordained by a god, nor is it because capitalists are smarter or worked harder than anyone else and earned that right. Nor is it because... It's because they took it. They started with trading, which many societies considered and understood as thievery, since it's the exchange of unequal values. This is still the way that mercantile capitalists accumulate wealth. They continued with land theft backed up by war and genocide, and which is still going on today, as we all know. I just got back from Haiti a few days ago and saw huge areas of land that had been stolen from small farmers and townspeople, their houses just bulldozed over without warning, so that the government could bring in foreign investors to build industrial parks and tourist resorts. They justified this by saying that the people would get jobs. They would be able to work in the new factories and hotels. And that's the standard way that capitalists have been getting their workforce for the past 250 years. The fundamental contradiction of capitalism, reproducing it and driving it forward, is capital versus labor and the production of surplus value for private accumulation. This process is what produces class divisions, class domination, and class struggle. Classes are groups of people defined by their role in social production. There are those who own and control it, and those are usually not the same people who use it, who are the ones exploited in the process. Besides exploitation, capitalism also uses oppressive practices like racism and patriarchy, and has terrible effects like ecocide and war, which we all have to deal with. It's a social system that dominates all of social life, and all the dominated classes and social groups struggle against this in their own ways. But the core of it is embodied in the struggle of workers against exploitation. Workers are the ones who faced capital in their daily struggle for existence in an inherently antagonistic relationship. They're the only ones able to offer an alternative to capitalism. Other classes can resist but can't break the framework. So if we're to actually destroy capitalism, the working class needs to lead all the dominated classes in a revolution to overthrow the capitalist class. Thanks. I'm glad that got a positive response, comrades. We're all social agents. Oh, okay. Want to get it right. So if we're actually to destroy capitalism, the working class needs to lead all the dominated classes in a revolution to overthrow the capitalist class. We're all social agents born into a structure that we didn't create. We're inserted into the existing relations of production, funneled into particular social slots serving the various requirements of capital. Capital confines our relationships within a framework of relations between things, and it treats living beings, including humans, as objects. It has no moral or ethical framework because it's not alive. Nevertheless, it does have emotion, drives, and imperatives of its own. Its only aim is self-expansion. Even capitalists are merely stewards of capital and have no control over it. If they have an attack of conscience and attempt to moderate it, then they're replaced. Sociopaths are drawn to this role. In fact, a higher percentage are found in this class than in the general population, because to serve capital in this way requires a lack or total suppression of empathy. Capital has no subjectivity and it doesn't recognize it in others, but it is animate through and embodied in its representatives. It imbues them with its own sociopathy. Surplus value is generated only in industrial production when labor power is exploited in the process of converting raw materials, otherwise known as the living world, into commodities, and that's why it's ecocidal. Other forms of capital expansion, such as mercantile and finance, create inflated bubbles of fictitious value through unequal trading and speculation. All that must be based on the production of physical goods. For example, China builds 12 to 24 ghost cities every year, mile after mile of malls with no businesses in them and houses with no people living in them. And those empty buildings serve as repositories for capital investment, objects to hold value and to speculate on. Surplus value must be reinvested as new capital or it will degrade, it will lose value. Capital will do whatever it takes to prevent its own devaluation, including all forms of brutal oppression, endless wars, total disregard for the needs of any living beings, stripping us of subjectivity and turning us into functions for its own reproduction, even up to the annihilation of all life on Earth. This would, of course, mean its own destruction as well. Marx understood this when he said that class struggle will lead to either the overthrow of capitalism and the elimination of class domination in general, or the common ruin of contending classes. And we still may have this choice to make, but that window is closing. We each need to make our choice now and do the work required of us in this very intense and pivotal historical period, the work of understanding the structural crisis and vulnerabilities of the system that we're facing, plus the work of organizing our forces so that we can become strong enough to weaken and ultimately destroy it. Thank you.
So before I start, I want to acknowledge the person who I think is probably the single most important person to be keeping this whole thing running smoothly and also has the worst job of anybody here, which is Max. He's sitting down there. This whole conference, he's doing nothing but watching his watch and then holding up signs saying, "Shut up." So it's, thank you. I would have killed myself by now. For how long have we known each other, Stephanie?
8 years.
8 years? So for 8 years, Stephanie and I have had a bitter, bitter ideological battle. It's so bitter that we've written a couple books together and have become very dear friends. But what I should, I guess, since we're both on the left, what we should do is, since we have this disagreement, we should have denounced each other publicly and... So I'm going to move. Actually, I had a disagreement with you today, too, so...
Revisionist scum. I'm just going to
move. Yeah, yeah. And we've been having essentially the same friendly disagreement. I don't even know if it's a disagreement, but a friendly, slight difference. And the question that Stephanie and I have been having a great time slightly disagreeing on is whether capitalism creates sociopathological behavior or whether it took sociopaths to create a rationalization for their pre-existing issues. and to create a system that rewards this terrible behavior? And I don't really have any answer. And I think the truth is that they're mutually reinforcing, that once you get a system in place that starts creating sociopaths, then they will create additional rationalizations for their sociopathological behavior and additional ways to reward themselves. And especially when, you know, basically those in power are the ones who are making the rules for those in power, then of course they're going to codify their pre-existing issues. So that was really the thing I wanted to say. And then the other thing I wanted to say is basically just everything I've said yesterday and today. So I'm going to cut mine way short. I do want to say one more thing. People have heard me talk of, you know, I say this and then go on for 3 hours. That you mentioned the commons, and there's, I got to tell you, the tragedy of the commons just pisses me off, that essay. And it's such a lie, because what it really should be called, I know you weren't saying this.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. The original essay by Garrett Hard, 1948 or something like that. He basically says that the tragedy of the commons is that if you have a common area, that it will be eventually destroyed. You can't have commons, because if you have an area, a community area where the village is allowed to run 100 sheep, and so every family, there's 10 families, each family can run 10 sheep, what's going to happen is one family is going to run 11 sheep, and then another family is going to run 11 sheep, and then eventually the commons will be destroyed. But this is complete bullshit, because what that is a tragedy of the failure of community. Because if you have a community, everybody knows that they can run 10 sheep, and if somebody runs 11 sheep, the other members of the community come to them and they say, dude, that is not a good idea. And if the person does it again, they say, dude, that's a really bad idea. And if they do it again, they burn down their house. And so what he's describing is a situation in which your community has already been destroyed. And so that's really, I just wanted to bring that up in terms of all this. And I agree with everything both of you said. And then my whole other thing is and which I don't think you probably disagree with, except that you have bitterly for 8 years. You know, it takes a sociopath to, it takes, I guess I do want to say one more thing, of course. Which is Jimi Hendrix, and I said this to you this morning. I always think about this, that no matter how talented he was, if Jimi Hendrix would have been playing his music in the 1920s, he would not have been found an audience. That you have to have a receptive audience in order to have something become popular. So if you have a purely functioning community in the first place, and somebody says, hey, I got this great idea, which is everybody acting selfishly will create a greater good for our entire community, they would say, you are nuts. And the only way you can have people go, wow, that's a great idea, is if they're primed for it. One more thing. In 1990, was that an election year? 1988. It's 92. The year that Clinton was elected, he did this one speech this is a great moment where he said that, I want to try to show that Adam Smith's invisible hand has a green thumb. And it was great because the entire audience was silent. And then he said, I thought that was a really good line. And everybody's like, oh, yeah. So the point is that was just a one of the ways that the whole propaganda, I mean, first, when everybody knows this, that it's like, Adam Smith's invisible hands, a green thumb, you're fucking nuts. But then, of course, when it's repeated, then, of course, if you have the New York Times take it up, and then if you have the neo-environmentalists take it up, and then if you have all these other groups take it up, by now, of course, you know, 20 years later, everybody's like, oh, yeah, of course, capitalism, green capitalism will solve everything. It's like, fuck you. But that's all.
And, you know, just a footnote to that comment. The thing that makes this community different is that 95% of environmentalists in America believe that the solution to the environmental crisis is more capitalism. I had the quote from Tom Friedman up there, who is probably, you know, the most in this book that he wrote on climate change, made that argument very powerfully. He said there's Father Capital and Mother Earth, the two most powerful forces in the world, and to be married together will solve our problem. So what's really, why this panel, if you came here as an environmentalist, why this panel is super important is that you're going up against a myth, a deeply embedded myth in the society, that the solution to climate change is more capitalism. And it's the problematic that we have to deal with here.
I want to respond to that. I would actually agree that there is father capitalism and mother earth, and it's a deeply abusive relationship in which he's beating the shit out of her and raping her on a daily basis. And what she needs to do is put a gun to his fucking head and kill him.
Okay, I have...
On that note...
I have four questions. I'm going to just read all four questions we got from the audience, and I'm going to let you all thumb wrestle for who can respond to them in what order. First question is, what is an appropriate response to intraspecies predators devoid of conscience? The second question is, how do we crush this? Okay.
I want that one.
Third one.
How do we crush this?
Please comment on the prospect and feasibility of a non-monetary society. And the last one is actually, you got 2 points on it. It says, does not real capitalism that runs our country operate by a cooperative arrangement with others in the 1%, including much of the government and top multinational corporations? Second point, does this fly in the face of the definition of capitalism? Cooperation seems to work very well. So there you go. Sonia.
I can just make a very quick point to the last one, in that capitalists do cooperate with each other. They just don't, they have an antagonistic relationship with the rest of us. I'd like to answer the, or address the how do we crush it one. Can we talk about
Didn't
that?
Did you write a book about that?
I think so. In my opinion, there's really no way to reform it, fix it. It's not a system that has gone too far or that has run off the rails. The rails are constructed that way. The whole system is born that way. It's not something that can be restrained or reformed, or fixed. It is not broken. It's doing exactly what has been predicted for the last 200 years. It's the accumulation of capital is an inevitable process. The concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands, the monopolization of production, that's all part of how it works. And the only way that it can be gotten rid of is if we organize and become a powerful social force, more powerful than the lies, wealth, and arms of our enemy. We have to first recognize it as our enemy. A lot of people don't, because we're frankly ideologically very dominated, and we've been conditioned for generations to accept this as normal. And the whole propaganda that there's no alternative, everything else has failed, nothing else will work, this is our only choice, we have to break out of that. Yes, there have been attempts at other systems that have failed, but these were babies trying to learn how to walk. And if they fall down, are we going to say this baby's never going to grow up and learn how to walk? We have to learn from the mistakes of people who have tried different things, modify that according to our current situation, and collectively figure out a different way to live. We evolved as collective beings. We're not like this. This, you know, this capitalist society has turned us into unsocial creatures, but we are social creatures. We're cooperative. This is our nature. So we have to organize and collectively build a movement, a mass movement that is strong enough, that is led by a politicized revolutionary working class, and overthrow them. Take over. Take over the political system. Get rid of it and institute our own, which is going to be built up in the process of the revolutionary struggle. And we need to take over the means of production and convert it to, instead of profit, human needs that are in line with the requirements of the natural world. And that's not an impossible dream. That is something that we would naturally do if we weren't being prevented by a class of people who controls everything and then enforces that control with their armed might. If we can be strong enough, organized enough to break through that armed might and control society ourselves, we can do a lot better. And we can, it's not going to be utopia, of course. There's going to be a lot to work through in the process and afterward. A lot of conflict among the people, but that's not an antagonistic conflict. That's conflict of, that we can work it out. The real antagonism is between all of us and those few at the top who are preventing a decent society from coming into being and who are killing us all.
So I want to just pick up on Stephanie's comment and some bad news and some good news. I just came back from Copenhagen and Stockholm, which I'd always thought of. If you think about the developed societies in the world, quote, developed, I always thought of Denmark and Sweden as among the more socially oriented capitalist models. I learned, I was there for 2 weeks just before I came here, and the whole social democratic, socially oriented model, you know, the carbon footprint of those countries is about a half to a third per capita of what it is in the United States. So it looks more attractive, even though it's obviously, you know. The problem is that they're not dealing with immigration very well, and they're not dealing with globalization very effectively. Can you hear me okay? And so even that very modest movement toward a more social model of capitalism is being contested very dramatically. I'm going to put one more, even worse piece of news, which is that the conversation we're having right here is not a conversation that's on the plate in the United States. You tell me how often you have seen in the New York Times or CNN or even MSNBC, any of the mainstream media, a conversation about whether we should have or get rid of capitalism. It's not a conversation that you're seen as friggin' crazy if you raise this question. This is simply the idea is not only that capitalism is the only good, it's the only possible way of organizing society. That's the bad news. And it's really bad because the ideological forces of control have consolidated around this idea, and it's only in very small niches of communities like this where this kind of question would even get on the table without being laughed off the floor. Now, here's possibly some sunnier news. First of all, when you ask people, I mean, we just had an election in which very right-wing groups took over not just much of Washington, but most of the state houses and even many local state areas where there seemed to be more hope. On the other hand, as I said, people are not paying attention to politics. So that was taken over with about something like $1 billion of Koch brother and related money and a very small percentage of people coming out to vote. When you actually question people about what they believe, it turns out they believe that capitalism is pretty fucked up. They think that capitalism is putting money into Washington and into political processes in a way that is pretty sociopathic. They are pissed off about the bailing out of the banks. They believe that people who work in McDonald's or in nursing homes deserve a living wage. They believe that unions are good things and that community is important. And they believe in the environment, the essential need to protect the environment. I've been looking at public opinion polls for a long time. This has been true all through the Reagan era. So there is a resonance, this word resonance that Derek has sort of put it, when do people become receptive to ideas? The contradiction that we're dealing with is, on the one hand, you can't even talk about what we're talking about today. Capitalism is the only reality that the ideological apparatus of the country will accept as an acceptable dialogue. And in a sense, there's a resonance to that. There aren't masses out in San Francisco, even, who are saying, we want to talk about class revolution or about capitalism, who would embrace what Stephanie just said. On the other hand, when you actually carefully interrogate people about what it is they believe on real issues, they want health care. They want good education for their kids. They want to save the environment for future generations. So there's sort of like a counter-resonance. There's a counterculture, and there's a counter, but it operates under the formal mechanism of politics, which has become spectacle and money-driven. And so somehow the practice of resistance and social change has to be sort of diving under the surface of that resonant controlling ideology and finding the way to speak to the parts of people's lives that are telling them everything is wrong in this society and that we need drastic change. So, you know, we have to be really smart, and I mean that in an emotional way. We have to find a way to viscerally hook into the deep discontents that people are experiencing about their lives and about their communities, about their kids' prospects, about their own prospects. They know they're a subject of abuse. It's a little bit like an abused child. To go back to themes that Derek was talking about yesterday, you take an abused child and you try to pull them away from their parents, and they will run to the parent that has been kicking them and hold on to their knees and say, don't take me away. I think the body politic in the United States is operating a little bit like that. They know that they're being abused, and they are holding on for dear life to the abuser. And what a resistance movement has to do is provide a source of safety and community that will allow people to realize, I can let go of that and actually get rid of it because it's been destroying my life.
I'm going to throw one more question that just came from the audience into the pot here and then let them stir it as they see fit. It's actually a fairly lengthy comment and question. It says, the analogy of sexist woman abuse is being used over-pointedly and liberally in this gathering. It undermines the work that anti-violence feminists have done to bring forward rape, incest, wife-beating, and prostitution into serious public discourse. Would you be willing to break the bad habit of conflating environmental devastation with sexist violence? I do agree there are strong connections, but they are not the same.
No, I won't. And I say this as a survivor of sexual abuse. The mindset that drives them is exactly what I was talking about with the man box. That's why I read the man box. No one is saying that a clear cut is a rape. What I am saying, at least, is that both are violations driven by the masculinist imperative of patriarchy. That's the point I'm making. And we can talk about that more in a minute if we want. But I want to respond to some other things. One of them is, was it Thomas Friedman who said that the 95% of environmentalists? Who was it who said the 95% of environmentalists believe in capitalism?
Well, Friedman himself.
Okay, he's not an environmentalist.
Well, he claims to be the New York Times leading environmentalist.
Microphone.
Oh, sorry. I think Tom Friedman has influenced the culture more than anybody else about how to think about environment and climate change.
Well, that's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
And the point I was making is that I can claim as a non-journalist that 95% of journalists are assholes.
Yeah.
And
especially Tom Friedman.
Yeah, especially Tom Friedman. And the point is that it's a very interesting distinction that something I was going to put in the talk yesterday, but I took out for time, is that a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and then they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. And that's because they start by asking, why is this land being destroyed? And then they start asking, why would any land be destroyed? And then they ask, they hear, you know, that the needs of the economy are in opposition to the needs of the environment. And they ask, why would you have an economic system that destroys, that says that the economic system is in opposition to the environment? And so that's something that there's this huge split between grassroots environmental activists and mainstream activists. And that split is, the split I was talking about yesterday was, where is their fundamental loyalty? And the split of the grassroots environmental activists, the ones that I knew and grew up with, is their emphasis is always biocentric. When you ask any environmental activist, why are you doing this work? Grassroots activist. And like there's one woman, this always makes me tear up. I asked her why she's doing the work, and she pointed to a picture on her desk. And the pictures are this tree. And I was like, well, I don't understand. And then you look at the tree more closely, and there's a little hole in the tree, and you see a baby owl poking his head out. And she says, I do this work for her. And if you ask a lot of, I'm going to ask, Lierre, why do you do the work you do to protect against domestic violence, etc.? Because she loves women and girls. It's like, where's your loyalty? And the loyalty of Tom Friedman is to capitalism. That's why he says, oh, those environmentalists, we environmentalists. So that's because what he's doing is this big propaganda thing to help us move. Okay, that's enough. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, as the two of you were talking on this question, is why I keep thinking about the line by Harriet Tubman, you know, I freed hundreds of slaves, but I could have freed hundreds more if only they had known they were slaves. And it's the same thing with capitalism. And one of our jobs in this sort of pre-revolutionary phase is to help people to articulate the understanding that they already have, that they are enslaved by the system, but they don't yet know it, just like the slaves that Harriet Tubman tried to free didn't know it. And then the third thing I wanted to say is...
One quick comment. You know, young people today are constantly surveyed around what they think of the word capitalism. But Rasmussen, Pew, and both liberal, conservative, mainstream polls have said that. It's very interesting. Do you know what percentage of people under the age of 30 have a positive association with the word capitalism? It's less than 50%. About the same percentage of people these are, of course, sort of meaningless things in a way, but just to give you a very general, visceral sense that there is an opportunity that the young people in the country have a feeling of what Derek is talking about, which is that their connection to their world is being destroyed. That at some level, that is translating into an understanding that there is something, that this is a symptom of something fundamentally wrong in their way of life. That the environmental destruction and climate change, as terrible as it is a symptom of something even deeper, which is the way we've constructed our civilization and our way of life. And this is the realm of possibility. Because I deal with these kids every day, and the kids I can't see are very progressive, but they have to go a long way in their movement from that very gut-level understanding to being able to articulate the connections that at some level they feel.
I agree that people are discontent. They understand that something's wrong. We can't go out and just talk about capitalism and abstract concepts at the start. But I go out a lot and talk with people and pass out flyers and stuff like that, trying to organize. And start out by saying it's really difficult to survive under this system where a few people take everything and we can't even make a living. And everybody is like, yeah, it's horrible. And I say, we have to organize to do something about it. We have to fight back against this. Yeah, we do. That's a very common response. So I think going back to the original question that we were addressing, how do we crush it? I talked about it in very general terms, but a lot of people really want something more concrete. Yes. There's no easy formula for it, and it takes, like you were saying, In order to make a political change, and a revolution is a political change, we need the ideological change first. In order to have a revolution in reality, we need to be able to imagine it in our minds. So having those conversations, organizing people means building relationships. So each person, if you can't find an organization that you agree with, just start one with a conversation with one person. That's how it starts. And then you find another person. And if you can't find one or you don't know one, then go out in the street and start talking to people. Write a quarter-page leaflet that says, this system's horrible and, you know, we need to do something. You don't have to have all the answers. You need to open the conversation and you need to have regular meetings. I know people don't like that, but you really need them. And you need to have study and you need to have action. And that action is widely varied. Even going out and talking to people, that's an action. That's how we start. So there's no easy way to do it. There's no way around the tedious work of just, you know, going out, putting yourself out there. There's no other way to do it. So I wanted to say that is the concrete answer for that question.
I've got, I think, three things. I want to go back to the talking about sexual abuse, and I just want to point out explicitly that one of the points of this conference, this is why we have anti-pornography and anti-prostitution activists at an environmental conference. That's the point, is that these are under the larger umbrella of exploitation. That's why this larger conversation is taking place together. You have all these environmental conferences, you have stop porn conferences, but they're not brought together. And that's the point here, is to bring these together under the larger umbrella. That's the point. Second thing is that how do we crush the system? I think that the way the North won the Civil War before it started. Germany lost World War II before it started. The way you win a war is by destroying the enemy's capacity to wage war. That's the point of war. And one of the things we need to do, well, we need to recruit first because there's like 15 of us. But one of the things we need to do is to destroy capitalism's ability to wage war on us and on the world. And then we're not quite there yet. And then the other thing is one of the really big barriers to recruitment is a wonderful metaphor that somebody told me. I was asking a fisheries biologist about blowing up dams. I can't imagine why I was asking this. And the fisheries biologist was saying that basically a flood is a natural process, but every time a river floods and changes course, it breaks her heart because all the fish and the frogs and the trees who are in the old channel die. But she said, that's what rivers do, is they change course all the time. And there's a phrase that just stuck with me so hard, which was, what happens every time a river floods is there is short-term habitat loss and long-term habitat gain. And as soon as she said that to me, I got chills thinking about, why do we stay in bad relationships? Because we're afraid of losing the short-term, we're afraid of the short-term loss for long-term gain. Why do we stay in bad jobs? Because we're afraid of the short-term loss for the long-term gain. And I am not in any way attempting to dismiss the terror involved in the collapse of any system, which is completely dreadful. But that's one of the biggest things that's holding us all back, I think, is because of a very, very, very real prospective of terrible short-term loss in exchange for the very obvious long-term gain that will be gained by getting rid of capitalism. And I'm just throwing that out as this is a huge, very real barrier that we all face.
We're out of time. And I want to thank the panelists. I want to thank the audience and let everybody know that on the hour, I believe, the break will be over. And Chris Hedges is going to be out here to talk to you. Thanks very much.